First, you have to go back to the book. She exchanged the pointer for the copy of River God. You remember the character of Tanus from the story?
Of course.
He was the commander of the Egyptian armies under Queen Lostris, with the title of Great Lion of Egypt. He led the exodus from Egypt when they were driven out by the Hyksos. He was also the queen's secret lover, and if we are to believe Taita, the father of Prince Memnon, her eldest son, she agreed. Tanus was killed during a punitive expedition against the Ethiopian chief named Akun in the high mountains, and his body was mummified and brought back to the queen by Taita. Nicholas expanded the story.
Precisely, she nodded.
This leads me on to the other clue that Duryad and I winkled out.
From the seventh scroll?
He unfolded his arms and sat forward in his seat.
No, not from the scrolls, but from the inscriptions in the tomb of Queen Lostris.
She reached into her bag and brought out another photograph. This is an enlargement of a section of the murals from the burial chamber, that part of the wall that later fell away and was lost when the alabaster jars were revealed. Duryad and I believe that the fact that Taita placed this inscription in the place of honour, over the hiding place of the scrolls, was significant. She passed the photograph to him, and he picked up a magnifying glass from the table to study it. While he puzzled over the hieroglyphics, Rayan went on.
You'll recall from the book how Taita loved riddles and word games, how he boasts so often that he is the greatest of all the Bower players.
Nicholas looked up from the magnifying glass.
Yes, I remember that. I go along with the theory that Bower was the forerunner of the game of chess. I have a dozen or so boards in the museum collection, some from Egypt and others from further south in Africa.
Yes, I would also subscribe to that theory. Both games have many of the same objects and rules, but Bower is a more rudimentary form of the game. It is played with coloured stones of different rank instead of chessmen. Well, I believe that Taita was not able to resist the temptation to display his riddling skills and his cleverness to posterity. I believe that he was so conceited that he deliberately left clues to the location of the pharaoh's tomb, both in the scrolls and amongst the murals that he tells us he painted with his own hands in the tomb of his beloved queen.
You think that this is one of those clues?
Nicholas tapped the photograph with the glass.
Read it, she instructed him. It's in classical hieroglyphics, not too difficult compared to his cryptic codes.
The father of the prince who is not the father, the giver of the blue that killed him, he translated haltingly, guards eternally, hand in hand, with Hapi, the stone testament of the pathway to the father of the prince who is not the father, the giver of blood and ashes.
Nicholas shook his head. No, it doesn't make sense, he protested. I must have made an error in the translation.
Don't despair. You're making your first acquaintance with Taita, the champion bower player and consummate riddler. Duryad and I puzzled over it for weeks, she reassured him.
To work it out, let's go back to the book.
Tanus was not the father of Prince Memnon in name, but as the queen's lover was his biological father. On his deathbed he gave Memnon the blue sword that had inflicted his own mortal wound during the battle with the native Ethiopian chief. There is a full description of the battle in the book.
Yes, when I first read that section I remember thinking that the blue sword was probably one of the very earliest iron weapons, and in an age of bronze would have been a marvel of the armourer's art.
A gift fit for a prince, Nicholas mused and went on.
So, the father of the prince, who is not the father, is Tanus.
He sighed with resignation.
For the moment, I accept your interpretation.
Thank you for your trust and confidence in me, she said sarcastically.
But to proceed with Taita's riddle.
Pharaoh Mamos was Memnon's father in name only, but not his blood father, again the father who was not the father. Mamos passed down to the prince the double crown of Egypt, the red and white crowns of upper and lower kingdoms, the blood and the ashes.
I am able to swallow that more easily.
What about the rest of the inscription? Nicholas was clearly intrigued.
Well, the expression hand in hand is ambiguous in ancient Egyptian. It could just as well mean very close to, or within sight of, something.
Yes, go on.
At last you have me sitting up and taking notice, Nicholas encouraged her.
Hapi is the hermaphroditic god or goddess of the Nile, depending on the gender he or she adopts at any particular moment. Throughout the scrolls, Taita uses Hapi as an alternative name for the river.
Yes, so if we put the seventh scroll and the inscription from the queen's tomb together, what then is your full interpretation? He insisted.
Simply this. Tanus is buried within sight of, or very close to, the river at the second waterfall. There is a stone monument or inscription on or in his tomb that points the way to the tomb of Pharaoh.
He exhaled through his teeth. Ugh, I'm exhausted from all this jumping to conclusions. What other clues have you ferreted out for me?
That's it, she said, and he looked at her with disbelief.
That's it?
Nothing else? He demanded.
And she shook her head.
Just suppose that you were correct so far. Let us suppose that the river is recognizably the same in shape and configuration as it was nearly 4,000 years ago. Let us further suppose that Taita was indeed pointing us towards the second waterfall at the Dandira River. Just what do we look for when we get there?
If there is a rock inscription, will it still be intact, or will it be eroded away by weather and the action of the river?
Howard Carter had an equally slender lead to the tomb of Tutankhamun, she pointed out mildly. A single piece of papyrus of dubious authenticity.
Howard Carter had only the area of the Valley of Kings to search. It still took him 10 years, he replied.
You have given me Ethiopia, a country twice the size of France. How long will that take us, do you think?
She stood up abruptly.
Excuse me, I think I should go and visit my mother in hospital. It's fairly obvious that I'm wasting my time here.
It's not yet visiting hours, he told her.
She has a private room.
Royan made for the door.
I will drive you to the hospital, he offered.
Don't bother. I'll call a taxi, she replied in a tone that crackled with ice.
A taxi will take an hour to get here, he warned,
and she relented just enough to let him lead her to the Range Rover. They drove in silence for 15 minutes before he spoke.
I'm not very good at apologies. Not much practice, I'm afraid, but I am sorry. I was abrupt. I didn't mean to be. Carried away by the excitement of the moment.
She did not reply, and after a minute he added, "You will have to talk to me, unless we are to correspond only by note. It'll be a bit awkward down in the Abai Gorge."
I had the distinct impression that you were no longer interested in going down there.
She stared ahead through the windscreen.
I am a brute, he agreed.
And she glanced sideways at him. It was her undoing. His grin was irresistible, and she laughed.
I suppose I just have to come to terms with that fact. You are a brute.
Still partners? He asked.
At the moment, you are the only brute I have. I suppose that I am stuck with you.
He dropped her off at the main hospital entrance.
I'll pick you up here at 3 o'clock, he told her,
and drove on into the centre of York.
From his university days, Nicholas had kept a small flat in one of the narrow alleys behind York Minster. The entire building was registered in the name of a Cayman Island company, and the unlisted telephone there did not route through an internal switchboard. No ownership could be traced to him personally. Before he had met Rosalind, the flat had played an important part in his social life. But nowadays Nicholas only used it for confidential and clandestine business. Both the Libyan and the Iraqi expeditions had been planned and organized from here. He hadn't used the flat for months, and it was cold and musty-smelling and uninviting. He put a match to the gas fire in the grate and filled the kettle. With a mug of steaming tea in front of him, he placed a call to a bank in Jersey, followed immediately by another to a bank in the Cayman Islands. A wise rat has more than one exit from its burrow. This was a family maxim, passed down through the generations. There should always be a little something tucked away for the day the heavens opened. He was going to need funds for the expedition, and the lawyers had most of those locked up already.
He gave the passwords and account numbers to each of the bank managers and instructed them to make certain transfers. It always amazed him how easily matters could be arranged, as long as you had money. He checked his watch. It was still early morning in Florida. But Allison picked up the phone on the second ring. She was the blonde, feminine dynamo who ran Global Safaris, a company that arranged hunting and fishing expeditions to remote areas around the world.
"Hello, Nick. Haven't heard from you in over a year. We thought you didn't love us anymore."
"I've been out of it for a while," he admitted. "How do you tell people that your wife and two little girls had died?"
"Ethiopia?"
She did not sound at all disconcerted by the request.
"When did you want to go?"
"How about next week?"
"You have to be joking. We only work with one hunter there, Nassus Roussos, and he's booked 2 years in advance."
"Is there nobody else?" he insisted. "I have to be in and out again before the big rains."
"What trophies are you after?" she hedged.
"Mountain Nyala? Menelik's Bushbuck?"
"I'm planning a collecting trip for the museum down the Abai River."
It was as much as he was prepared to tell her. She hedged a little longer and then told him reluctantly,
"This is without our recommendation, you do understand. There is only one hunter who may take you on such short notice, but I don't even know if he has a camp on the Blue Nile. He's a Russian, and we have had mixed reports about him. Some people say he's ex-KGB and was one of Mengistu's bunch of thugs."
Mengistu was the Black Stalin, who had deposed and then murdered the old Emperor Haile Selassie, and in 16 years of despotic Marxist rule had driven Ethiopia to its knees. When his sponsor, the Soviet Empire, had collapsed, Mengistu had been overthrown and fled the country.
"I'm desperate enough to go to bed with the devil," he told her. "I promise I won't come back to you with any complaints."
"Okay, then. No comebacks." And she gave him a name and a telephone number in Addis Ababa.
"I love you, Allison, darling," Nicholas told her.
"I wish," she said, and hung up on him. He didn't expect that it would be easy to phone Addis, and he wasn't disappointed in his expectations. But at last he got through. A woman with a sweet, lisping Ethiopian accent answered and switched to fluent English when he asked for Boris Brusilov.
"He is out on safari at present," she told him. "I am Waziro Tesai, his wife."
In Ethiopia, a wife did not take on her husband's name. Nicholas remembered enough of the language to know that the name meant Lady Sun, a pretty name.
"But if it is in connection with safari business, I can help you," said Lady Sun.
Nicholas picked Royan up outside the hospital entrance.
"How's your mother?"
"Her leg is doing well, but she's still distraught about magic, about her dog."
"You'll have to get her a puppy."
"One of my keepers breeds first-class springers. I can arrange it." He paused and then asked delicately,
"Will you be able to leave your mother? I mean, if we're going out to Africa?"
"I spoke to her about that. There is a woman from her church group who will stay with her until she's well enough to fend for herself again."
Ryan turned fully around in her seat to examine his face.
"You've been up to something since I last saw you," she accused him. "I can see it in your face." He made the Arabic sign against the evil eye.
"Allah save me from witches."
"Come on." He could make her laugh so readily. She was not sure if it was a good thing or not. "Come on, tell me what you've got up your sleeve."
"Wait until we get back to the museum."
He would not be moved, and she had to bridle her impatience. As soon as they entered the building, he led her through the Egyptian room to the Hall of African Mammals and then stopped her in front of a diorama of mounted antelope. These were some of the smaller and medium-sized varieties: Impala, Thompson's and Grant's Gazelle, Geranuk and the like. "Madakwa haparai." He pointed to a tiny creature in one corner of the display. "Harper's Dikdik, also known as the striped Dikdik.